I'm going to turn this evening to Genesis chapter 13.
Those of you who've been coming to Bristol for some years know that Jim can't help being ugly. As a matter of fact, I understand from somebody close to the family that Jim Redling actually failed childhood. They tell me he was so ugly that when his mother came home from the hospital and was going to make her first appearance at church, she borrowed his cousin. Always like to help the people in the books. A little volume here that I think you ought to put in your library. Mr. Ford was telling us this morning that one of the principles of hermeneutics is that no illustration can be bigger than the thing it illustrates. Another principle of hermeneutics, and it's an absolutely basic, fundamental principle. You can't properly interpret the Bible unless you interpret it grammatically, historically, and culturally. When you're studying the Gospels, for example, you must, to properly interpret the Gospels, have an understanding of the grammatical, historical, cultural background of the passage. This book by Alfred Edersheim, The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, is a classic upon the background of the four Gospels. If you are a serious student of the Bible, next to exploring Revelation, you ought to have that book on your library shelf. Genesis chapter 13. Abraham went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him into the south. Abraham was very rich in cattle, in silver and in gold. And he went on his journeys from the south even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Hai, unto the place of the altar which he had made there at the first, and there Abraham called on the name of the Lord. Lot also went with Abraham as flocks and herds and tents, and the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together, for their substance was great, so that they could not dwell together. And there was strife between the herdmen of Abraham's cattle and the herdmen of Lot's cattle, and the Canaanites and the Perizzites were then in the land. And Abraham said unto Lot, let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, between my herdmen and thy herdmen, or we be brethren. By the way, another hermeneutical principle is the law of first mention, and this is the first mention of the brethren in the Bible, and you'll notice in the context they're squabbling. Abraham said unto Lot, we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou take the left hand, I'll go to the right. If thou depart to the right hand, I'll go to the left. And Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. Then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves the one from the other. Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent toward Sodom, but the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. May the Lord add his blessing to the reading of his word. Somebody told me one time that by the time a person is 60 years of age, if he lives in a land like this, he's probably eaten about 30 tons of food. Supposing you took a newborn infant and set 30 tons of food in front of the little fellow and said, "Now, here you are, son, eat that." Well, of course, he couldn't do it. But if he tried, he'd certainly die in the attempt. I've got a teenage son at home. I don't think his 30 tons is going to last him. But you see, the point is that a child needs and takes only what it needs for the day. You only eat one meal at a time, at least most people. You only take one step at a time. You only live one day at a time. That's how life is. You know, there was once a time when somebody had to say to the famous Albert Einstein, "Now look here, Albert, you've got to understand that 2 + 2 = 4. Of course, afterwards he advanced a little bit beyond that, but that's where he had to start. Had to start where everybody starts, at the beginning. And everybody makes mistakes. And that's where Abraham started. You remember yesterday we thought of Abraham believing. And then we thought of Abraham backsliding. He took a few steps, and then down he went with a terrible smash. Now he picked himself up, shaken, soiled, and saddened. And he tries again to walk this life of faith, a wiser and a sadder man. And in this chapter that we're going to look at this evening, we're going to see that Abraham takes a giant step forward in the life of faith. He was a saved man in chapter 12. He's a spiritual man in chapter 13. The chapter divides into three parts. In verses 1 to 4, we have set before us the mark of a spiritual man. In verses 5 to 9, we have set before us the mind of a spiritual man. And in the rest of the chapter, we have set before us the mood of a spiritual man. Now, the first mark of a spiritual man is given to us in verse 1. It's the mark of separation. Abraham went up out of Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had, and Lot went with him into the south. Now, I can't remember for years and years hearing a message on separation. Nowadays, it's not a very popular theme. Nowadays, you know, you'd expect Elijah to do the opposite from what he did when he slaughtered the false prophets of Baal. You'd expect, according to the modern way of looking at things, that Elijah would come in to King Ahab with a $1 million smile and a big handshake, fresh from a Dale Carnegie course on how to make friends and influence people. And he'd pull up a chair and he'd say to Ahab, "Now look here, let's find some middle ground. Let's come to some agreeable terms. Let's explore the possibilities of coexistence. Let's see if we can't find some new approach to our differences." That's not the way it is in the Bible. Some time ago I heard about a business company that decided to put in a group insurance plan. And in order to inaugurate this insurance plan, it was necessary to have 100% participation. Everybody in the company had to sign up or the thing couldn't go through. Well, everybody in the company agreed, all except one fellow. He said he didn't want it. The boss went over him and said, "I hear you don't want to take out the company insurance." Fella said, "That's right." Boss said, "Is that your toolkit over there?"
fellow said yes.
The boss said, well, lock it up and close up your lunchbox and go to the office and pick up your check and keep on going. Fellow said, I'm ready to sign up right away. The boss said, why didn't you do it before? And the man said, I never had it explained to me like that before. Well, maybe you've never had it explained like this to you before. But there can be no practical sanctification for the believer without practical separation too. The two things are opposite sides of the same coin. The first mark of the spiritual man in Genesis chapter 13 is the mark of separation. Abraham went up out of Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had. He should never have gone down there in the first place. But now he's seen the truth. It's been explained to him in an unforgettable way. Pharaoh said, get out and stay out. And he learns the painful hard way, the truth of separation. He has learned in an unforgettable way that if he's going to grow in grace and increase in the knowledge of God, he can't do it in Egypt. Now the second mark of the spiritual man is in verses 2 and 3. It's the mark of sanctification. That's the other side of the same coin. Abraham, we read, was very rich in cattle, silver, and gold. He went on his journeys from the south to Bethel and to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai. If you look at the map, you'll see that he put as much space as possible between himself and Egypt. That's always a good thing to do. You see, we're not only separated from the world, we're separated through God. That's what sanctification is. Years ago, I heard about a woman in England who wanted a coachman. And she advertised in the local press for a man to come and drive her coach. And she had 3 applicants for the job. She called them in one at a time and she asked each of them the same question. She said, you consider yourself a good coachman? The man said, yes. You're familiar with that steep hill just outside the town? Oh, yes. Well, you know that really narrow curve on the hill where the road drops away to a gully 100 feet below? Yes, ma'am. Nasty stretch of road. Well, if you were my coachman, how close could you drive my horses and my coach to the edge of that precipice without losing your nerve? First man said, well, ma'am, he says, I reckon I could come within 6 inches of the edge without any problem at all. The second man, when he came in and was asked the same question, he said, ma'am, he says, give me a good team of horses and I wouldn't turn a hair even if one wheel went over the edge. But you know, it was the third man who got the job. He says, ma'am, he said, I keep that coach as far as possible from the edge. That's what sanctification is. It's putting some distance between yourself and all the potential sources of trouble that can come to you from the world and the flesh and the devil. It's not only separation from, it's separation to. And Abraham went back to Bethel, back to the house of God, back to the place where his tent and his altar had been at the beginning. And he reestablished his pilgrim character, and he pitched his tent, and he built his altar. Which introduces the third mark of the spiritual man. He's not only marked by separation and sanctification, he's marked by sacrifice. Unto the place of the altar, which he had made there at the first. Abraham's tent symbolized his relationship towards this world. He was a pilgrim and a stranger. He refused to allow his roots to go down very deeply into this world. He was determined that he was going to remain a mobilized man, always at the divine call, willing to move at a moment's notice at the call of God. And his altar symbolized his attitude towards the world to come. It said about Abraham that he was willing for any sacrifice, and so he was. The last time you see Abraham's altar, he's got his son Isaac stretched upon it. He was willing to go all the way with God. No rival, no refusal, no retreat. Absolute sacrifice. His all on the altar was laid. And that altar of Abraham signifies to us today that he was keeping the lines of communication open with God, and he was listening to what God had to say to him. You know, there's nothing worse than having the lines of communication interrupted. You ever tried to call home and get a busy signal? I don't know if you've ever tried to live in a house with one wife and three teenage daughters. I have, and it's a hopeless proposition trying to get home on the telephone. Line is always busy. I wonder how many times God has tried to get through to you. But you've been so busy, all the lines of communication have been so taken up with all the trivia of this earth that God can't get through. Abraham, we are told, called upon the name of the Lord. He set up his family altar and he told the Lord that he was from now on going to be a separated man. He was going to be a sanctified man. He was going to be a sacrificing man. Those are the marks of the spiritual man. In verses 5 to 9, we have set before us in this chapter the mind of a spiritual man. You see Abraham's attitude towards worrying circumstances in verses 5 and 6. You see his attitude towards wicked neighbors in verse 7. And you see his attitude towards weaker brethren in verses 8 and 9. And in these verses 5 to 9, you have clearly set before you the mind of a spiritual man. Spiritual man doesn't think the same way as a carnal man thinks. The spiritual man has the mind of Christ. And he thinks the way God would think, given a set of circumstances. Look at the worrying circumstances set before him in verses 5 to 6. We are told that the Lot also which went with Abraham had flocks and herds and tents, and the land was not able to bear them that they might dwell together. For their substance was great so that they could not dwell together. There's the problem. Now the natural reaction, of course, would be to say to Lot, now look here, my dear brother. This land belongs to me. God promised it to me and not to you. You'll simply have to go somewhere else. But do you notice what Abraham does in verses 5 and 6? He doesn't do anything. He's learned already what happens when you take the law into your own hands and start to provide your own solutions to worrying circumstances. He learned that in chapter 12. A number of years ago, when my father, who was at that time a businessman in South Wales, was exercised about going full-time into the Lord's work, there were quite a number of perplexing and almost contradictory circumstances. And he was in some perplexity to know exactly what was the mind of God for him. He went down to the city of Cardiff and he paid a visit to a good friend of ours by the name of Stephen Alford. And he said, Stephen, he said, look, I want to set this out before you. Now tell me. And he explained to him the problem and he said, now what should I do? Stephen Alford looked at my father and he said, Len, he said, if you don't know what to do, don't do it. Later on, those worrying circumstances resolved themselves into clear leading from the Lord. But at this juncture, you see, Abraham didn't know what to do, so he didn't do it. That's the mind of a spiritual man. He was willing now to wait on God until God made it perfectly clear in his soul what he should do next. In verse 7, you have the problem of wicked neighbors. We read there was strife between the herdmen of Abraham's cattle and the herdmen of Lot's cattle, and the Canaanites and the Perizzites were then in the land. Now it's bad enough, isn't it, when the Lord's people squabble amongst themselves? But it's a thousand times worse when they have to so squabble that the unbelievers and the unregenerate and the wicked who are looking on come to know all about it. It had come to this in the case of Abraham, and now he could no longer afford to wait. Something had to be done. You remember what Paul said to the Philippians? He said, do all things without murmurings and disputing, that ye may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation among whom ye shine as lights in the world. That's exactly what we have here, illustrated for us in Genesis chapter 13. Because nothing, you see, will mar the testimony of the Lord's people more quickly than squabbling and backbiting and bickering and fighting amongst the people of God. Do you remember who Hobab was? Anybody here know who Hobab was? Who was Hobab? You read about Hobab in Numbers chapter 10 and verse 29, and he was Moses' brother-in-law. Fancy not knowing that. I could understand not knowing who his mother-in-law was, but he ought to know who his brother-in-law was. Well, you know what Moses said to Hobab? He said, and it was a wonderful testimony, Moses said unto Hobab, he said, we are journeying unto the place of which the Lord God said, I will give it you, come thou with us, and we will do thee good, for the Lord hath spoken good concerning Israel. That's a great testimony, wasn't it? Do you know what Hobab said? He says, I'll not go. Why do you think Hobab said that? Well, if you go back into the preceding context of the chapter, you'll discover that if Hobab had spent any time at all amongst the people of God, all he'd seen ever since they got out of Egypt were murmurings and disputing. And he said to Moses, no thanks. Thanks a lot, but I've seen what your fellows are like, and I'd just as soon not have anything to do with it. So you have Abraham's attitude towards worrying circumstances in verse 5 and 6, and towards wicked neighbors in verse 7. He was very concerned because this quabble had now broken out into the open, and the Canaanites and the Perizzites were then in the land, and they were looking on. And then you have his attitude towards weaker brethren in verses 8 and 9. As you'll notice, it's the spiritual man who makes the move in this seeming impasse caused by worrying circumstances and aggravated by wicked neighbors. What Abraham did at this critical juncture proves him to be a spiritual-minded man. We well know, of course, that Lot was the weaker brother. For all we can see from the Old Testament, he had what we might call a second-hand faith. He'd been carried along this far in his spiritual life by the force of Abraham's character, testimony, and example. And he's in no spiritual condition to make the kind of sacrifice called for by this situation, but Abraham is. He's already erected his altar, you see. He's already told God, in effect, Lord, I'll give up anything for you. And now God puts him to the test. This is the first of five things in the book of Genesis that Abraham was asked by God to give up. The second rather. You'll notice that in dealing with his weaker brother, he deals with him with spiritual directness. Abraham said unto Lot, let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdsmen and thy herdsmen. Oh, what grace and condescension. He names himself first, as though he were the cause of all the trouble. That's a spiritual man for you. He's saying, in effect, my dear brother, this squabbling is really all my fault. And then he comes straight to the point and he calls it exactly what it is, strife. Now, we are very clever nowadays at inventing fancy names for sinful habits. We say that a man is a prevaricator. God says he's a liar. I once heard him described as an extrovert with a lively imagination. God says he's a liar. Nowadays we say that a man is an alcoholic. God says he's a drunkard. Psychiatrists come along and tell us it's a disease, but they don't explain why we spend millions of dollars every year trying to spread it. Nowadays we say a man is having a traumatic experience. God says he's got a bad temper. And Abraham, he looked this problem squarely in the face. He said, brother, he says, this is strife, and it's got to stop. And I'll take the blame for it. That's the way a spiritual man thinks. That's the mind of a spiritual man. He dealt with this problem about the weaker brother with spiritual directness. Also, he dealt with it with spiritual discernment. Let there be no strife, he says, for we be brethren. Now, my dear brother, he says, the things that unite us are far more important than the things that divide us. You know, the things that divide us as the Lord's people are often very petty and paltry, aren't they? I remember when I was on the staff of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. You know, you think when you get to a place like Moody Bible Institute, you've arrived at one of the suburbs of heaven, and all the Lord's people are perfect, but they aren't, you see. We had two ladies in our office, and they both had to share the same little office. And one of these ladies always wanted the window open, and the other always wanted it shut. Now, of course, you don't have any problems like that, but that's the kind of problem that came up. It wasn't a great big problem, it was just a little problem. And the one lady kept on saying, I'm going to catch my death of cold with that window open all the time. And the other lady kept on saying, I'm going to suffocate with that window shut all the time. And then somebody came up with a wonderful suggestion. He says, why don't we leave the window closed until one lady dies of suffocation, and then open it till the other woman dies of pneumonia, and then we'll have some peace. You know that squabble was always such a silly thing, what? Were they going to have the window open or were they going to have it shut? But it's called a fellowship. And it grieved the Holy Spirit. And these two dear saints, and I love both of them, they were just delightful Christians. You put them one in another office and one in this office, and they were great. They got along fine. Put them in together. But you see, they forgot all the things that united them with the silly thing that was dividing. They forgot the common faith they had in a risen Christ. They forgot their eternal membership in the body. They forgot they had one Lord and one faith and one baptism and one body and one spirit and one calling and one God who is above all and through all and in all. And they were squabbling about nothing. Abraham says to his brother Lot, he says, my dear brother, the things that unite us are far more important than the things that divide us. The only thing that's dividing us is a bit of cattle and country. He says, we be brethren. This is what ought to hold us together. But you know, the sad thing is, Lot couldn't see it that way. And then he treats Lot not only with spiritual directness and spiritual discernment, but he treats him with spiritual dignity. He says, is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. He says, my dear brother, you choose and I'll take what's left. You know, if Lot had been a spiritual man too, he'd have said to Abraham, look, my dear brother, let's sell some of these cattle. Let's give the proceeds to the Lord's work, or let's stay in fellowship. What a magnificent statement of surrender by Abraham. He laid aside all his rights, mark you, the rights that were his socially as Lot senior, the rights that were his sovereignly as by far the dominant of the two characters, and the right that was his spiritually as the sole heir and beneficiary of the divine promise. But you see, he'd been to the altar. He had the marks of a spiritual man. He had learned the truth of separation and the truth of sanctification and the truth of sacrifice. And he's able to say to his brother, I'll take the second place. Spurgeon once said, it takes more grace than I can tell to play the second fiddle well. And that's exactly what Abraham did at this particular point in his spiritual pilgrimage. And so you see, you've got the marks of a spiritual man and you've got the mind of a spiritual man. And then in the rest of the chapter, you have set before you the moves of a spiritual man. You see Abraham restrained by God in verses 10 to 13. You see him reassured by God in verses 14 and 16, and you see him regulated by God in verses 17 to 18, the moves of a spiritual man. You notice, first of all, he's a man who is restrained by God. Now, I'm going to explain what I mean by that in just a moment. But I want to do what the chapter does at this point. I want to show you why Lot made the decision he did. Because if Abraham acted in this situation under divine restraint, Lot acted with carnal resolve. There are three things set out here that mark out Lot's choice, and I want you to notice them because so often our choices are motivated and marked by the same three things. You notice, first of all, in connection with Lot, that he was weak in his devotion. We are told at the beginning of the chapter that Abraham was rich in cattle and in silver and in gold, but we are also told that he had an altar. You read about Lot, that Lot had flocks and herds and tents, but you don't read any reference anywhere in this chapter or anywhere else about Lot's altar. There's not the slightest suggestion anywhere that Lot ever had an altar. There's no suggestion, therefore, that Lot knew what it was to be in direct communication with God. He didn't know what it was to get up in the morning and set up his family altar and start this divine communication with Lord and say, speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth, speak just now some message to meet my need, which thou only dost know. Lot thought he could get on quite well without any word from God. At the beginning of the day, he was weak in his devotions. I suppose anyone who has done any measure of counseling amongst the Lord's people has discovered this basic fact that all backsliding begins with the breakdown of the daily quiet time with God. When you start to neglect your daily altar and you no longer keep these lines of communication open with the Lord, and you begin to neglect the Word of God, and you become weak in your devotions. The second thing about Lot was he was worldly in his desires. Verse 10, he lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan. It was well watered everywhere, as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Zoar. Now, Lot didn't ask, is this a good place to raise children? He asked, is this a good place to raise cattle? And he had two reasons for going down to Sodom, you see. He had what we could call his religious reason. It was like the Garden of Eden. It was like the paradise of God. It was like a little bit of heaven on earth down there, or so he thought. That was his religious reason. It was like the Garden of the Lord. But then we have his real reason. It was like the land of Egypt. That was his real reason. He'd already got a taste of Egypt, hadn't he? And who gave it to him? Oh, my friend, learn this tremendous lesson. The great tragedy of backsliding is not so much that you backslide, bad as that is. It's the influence you are on other people in that backslidden condition. Abraham was recovered, and he was in some senses a stronger man as a result of that experience. But what he taught Lot ruined him. It ruined him. Lot never recovered from that trip down to Egypt. And Abraham had to have that on his conscience to the end of his day. You see a man then who is weak in his devotion. You see a man who is worldly in his desires. And you see a man who is therefore consequently, inevitably, wrong in his decisions. He chose him all the plain of Jordan. He journeyed east. And then we read, but the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. It has been well said that the first question that comes to a human soul is this: heaven or hell? We had that set before us so forcibly this morning, didn't we? Heaven or hell? And you answer the first question, I take it that most of us, if not all of us here this evening, have answered that question. It's going to be heaven. I don't want to go to hell. But then, you know, the second question that comes is this: heaven or earth? Lot answered the first question when he got out of Mesopotamia. He answered the second question when he went down to Sodom. Now let's come back to Abraham for a few moments and notice the moves of a spiritual man. The Bible says that the steps of a good man are ordered of the Lord. And dear old George Buller of Bristol, that saint of God, he added this. He said, yes, he said, and also the steps of a good man are ordered of the Lord. You see now how Abraham is restrained by God. You see, God was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah and those cities of the plain. Within a few chapters, they're going to be wiped off the map. But you say, Lot didn't know that. Of course he didn't. Neither did Abraham. But God did. And because God knew, he restrained Abraham. And thus the steps of a good man were ordered of the Lord. Thus you see then,
The move of a spiritual man, he's restrained by God. And then you see a man who is reassured by God in verses 14 to 16. Now you'll remember that we read that Lot journeyed east. Now mark well what God said to Abraham. The Lord said unto Abraham after Lot was separated from him, lift up thou thine eyes and look from the place where thou art, northward and southward and eastward. Lot journeyed east. The Lord said to Abraham, look eastward. He says, I'm going to give it back to you, every bit of it. Down there, the well-watered plains gleaming like emeralds and sapphires in the sunshine. Down there, Lot, flocks and herds and tents, mere specks upon the horizon. Down there, nestling in the plain, the pine city. God says, all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. Abraham, you see, hadn't lost anything else. He gave it all up for God, and God turned around and gave it all back to him. You know how our arithmetic goes? It's quite different to heaven's arithmetic. According to our arithmetic, if you subtract one from one, you've got nothing. But according to God, if you subtract one from one, you've still got everything. Everyone, he says, that have forsaken houses, or brethren, or sisters, or father, or mother, or wife, or children, or lands, for my name's sake shall receive an hundredfold, and shall inherit everlasting life. That's God's arithmetic. And so you see the Lord not only restraining Abraham, you see him reassuring Abraham as to his possession and as to his posterity. He says, I'll make your seed as the dust of the earth. Now Abraham only had one son. He only had one son. I'd like to ask you a question. If you were to go out into the countryside and you could see a great oak tree and it was in the fall and it was laden down with acorns, you know, if you had patience and time, you could count exactly how many acorns were on that tree. But supposing you picked up just one acorn and looked at it, there's no man in all the world who could tell you how many oak trees are in that acorn. That's what God did to Abraham. He says, I'm going to give you a seed that nobody will be able to count. And he started by giving him just one son. But everything was in that one son. You see, the moves of a spiritual man will result in fruitfulness. And that doesn't mean to say that you are going to be like the evangelist that God is blessing who leads hundreds and thousands of people to Christ. Doesn't necessarily mean that. But it does mean that God, if you have the marks of a spiritual man, and if you have the mind of a spiritual man, and if you're making the moves of a spiritual man, it does mean that God will bless your ministry so that your seed in the end, when God opens the great account books of heaven, will be as the dust of the earth for multitude. I'd like to give you just one illustration as I close. Reading the book of Romans changed the life of Martin Luther. Martin Luther. Reading Martin Luther's preface to this epistle transformed the life of John Wesley. Martin Luther, now John Wesley. The historian Lecky says of Wesley that his conversion was one of the greatest epochs of English history. He says that the religious revolution begun in England by the preaching of the Wesley was of greater historical importance than all the splendid victories by sea and land won under Pitt, the Prime Minister. John Wesley paid more turnpikes than ever man who bestrode a beast. 8,000 miles was his annual journey with the gospel, every year preaching more than 1,000 times. No single figure ever influenced so many minds No single voice ever touched so many hearts. No other man ever did such a light work for England as John Wesley. It was the fruit of something that Martin Luther had done. Martin Luther, John Wesley. Attending a chapel of the primitive Methodists, one of the groups that followed in the steps of John Wesley led to the conversion of Charles Spurgeon. In turn, Charles Spurgeon touched the life of young Henry Morehouse. And then Henry Morehouse came over to Chicago and touched the life of D.L. Moody. He became known as the man who moved millions. One of the most famous missionaries to go from England was a man named C.T. Studd. He had attended some of Moody's meetings at Stratford and his faith caught fire. It was a real thing, he said. And after the Moody Crusade, C.T. Studd and six others, all converts or helpers of Moody, came together and offered themselves for China. They became known as the Cambridge Seven.